Welcome to On DOD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, your host, Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening to On DOD this week. Glad you're with us. I'm Jared Serbu. We're going to spend the bulk of our hour this week on a single topic, the public hotline operated by the Defense Department's Inspector General. It's a discussion not just about how that reporting service operates, but also about how some relatively simple business process changes within that office have made it a more efficient organization and more focused on its core mission. As we'll hear this hour, up until very recently, more than half of all the phone calls the hotline got had nothing to do with the reasons Congress told IGs to create those hotlines in the first place. The DOD IG says those calls are now going to the right places, and the hotline staff is more focused on what they're trained for, including handling reports of threats to life and safety and fraud and abuse within DOD. Our guest for this is Patrick Gookin, the director of the DOD IG's hotline. He took over that position in the spring of last year. We sat down and talked at the IG's headquarters office in Alexandria, Virginia.
We provide a reliable and secure means to report incidences of fraud, waste, abuse, or classified information leaks, or threats to public safety or homeland security, to report here to the DOD hotline. And then we send out referrals to the respective organization that needs to look into these matters, whether it's within the DOD IG or outside the DOD IG. And then after the matters are looked at, we conduct oversight of how it was, make sure it was done in accordance with regulations.
Describe that oversight piece a little bit more.
It's in the form of a hotline completion report, and we want to make sure that the person looking at it was independent and that they covered all of the elements of an offense and that was fair and impartial, and we review it to make sure it was, and if it's not, we send back the replies telling them that they missed part of it and ask them to get that part for us.
So in other words, look, we took in this complaint. You know, did you guys address it appropriately or address all the elements of it?
That's correct. And most of them are. It's very rare that we have to send back a memorandum of deficiency to ask them to correct something.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about what is and what is not appropriate subject matter to come to the hotline, because I know in the past you guys have gotten calls that are really not your purview to handle. What should people be calling the hotline about, and what should they not be calling about?
Well, first I'd like to explain that if you call us about something or send us an electronic form about something that's not within our purview, we try to get it to the people that do have purview over it. Rather than just tell you you've got the wrong number, we're not going to help you. We try to get them the right place.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, one of the most important things to many people that we don't handle is pay and allowance matters that are the responsibility of the Defense Finance and Accounting Service, DFAS. So although by regulation we're precluded from handling them because it's the DFAS matter that they're supposed to handle, we still were considering them a priority two matter, which is the second highest level we could have, because we wanted to make sure that the people were being taken care of with their pay. We have now created through an interactive process with DFAS that when you call our phone number and if we ask you if it's about in our phone tree, we ask you if it's a pay and allowance matter, press 1. When you press 1, it sends you to DFAS. Mm. Rather than, so in the speed of an electron, you're at the right place.
So that's got to take a pretty substantial amount of workload off of your staff.
Absolutely. Our phone tree was designed to be effective and efficient. And when we implemented this new phone tree October 1st, the number of phone calls dropped over 60%.
Wow.
And so that means over 60% of the items we were triaging and working on were not within our purview. And now we are able to focus more readily on the things that are within our purview.
And I assume these were calls like, oh, there was an excessive amount of withholding from my paycheck, there was a bookkeeping error, whatever.
We're not sure because we don't get into their pay matters. Mm-hmm. We just know that they had a problem with their pay and we want to help them. Even if it's not within our purview, we're going to help them.
Mm-hmm. So that's an example of things that aren't really within your purview. What are some examples of things that are? What do you want people to be calling about?
Well, our priority one matters are life, health, safety. The safety and security of America, the Department of Defense, all the people, our allies, anyone. We're not a 911 call center. We don't typically get emergencies, But when we get someone who calls us and it's an emergency, we've refined our processes to get that emergency sent to the right respective organization with purview within seconds or minutes.
And is that a recent change, that sort of rapid response capability?
It's a recent improvement. Mm. We've always had a mechanism to do it, but we've refined that process, just like many other processes, by interactive policy, interactive processes with other organizations. For instance, we work through the Joint Staff IG and the CENTCOM IG so that if we have someone in Afghanistan who is in an emergency situation and has called our hotline, in a matter of minutes, we can be talking to someone in the same compound with the purview to handle that matter.
So what are the kinds of things that you would look at as, you know, issues that need urgent attention? Can you illustrate that a little bit?
Sure. One example is an instance where someone might be contemplating harming themselves or someone else. We would treat that as an emergency, and we would work that to the exclusion of everything else until it's in the hands of the proper authorities,
mm-hmm.
whether that's in Afghanistan or in Columbus, Ohio, with the sheriff's office or police department.
Mm-hmm.
We find out where it is, who has jurisdiction, and get them immediately.
So those life and safety issues, I'm not sure that people normally in their minds associate that with the DOD Inspector General's office. I think they think of waste, fraud, abuse, those kinds of things. Do those also fall in priority one, or are we moving down the chain to priority two? Just describe how that continuum kind of works.
It, first of all, we're traditionally not thought of a life, health, safety, but that is actually our mission also, and it's one of our most important missions. In fact, it is probably our most important mission, the safety and security of our nation. The fraud, waste, and abuse, it depends on the extent of it, which priority level would come into one, two, or three, and any ripple effect that particular complaint may have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so to give you an example, a $20 travel fraud wouldn't be a priority one, but a billions of dollar fraud where now somehow that is also creating a risk of perhaps counterfeit parts in an aircraft or something like that,
mm-hmm.
That creates a much higher, that's priority one. We have a metric that any priority one has to be referred out our door within one workday, and we meet that metric. There's also a more stringent metric for a priority one that is an emergency, that the person on the phone who might hurt someone or themselves, and that is, it's immediate, and it's, there's no delay, there's no doing anything else to the exclusion of everything else, you're working on that matter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, priority two are things like reprisal and matters that might have congressional interest, and there's more to the category, but that's a general example. And the metric for referring that is within 3 workdays. We meet that metric.
Mm-hmm.
Priority three is everything else that is within the interests of the Department of Defense that doesn't meet the definitions of priority ones and priority twos. And the metric for that is we refer them within 10 days of receipt,
mm-hmm.
10 work days.
So especially in those cases that you turn around and get out the door quickly, can you kind of describe how much sort of triage, or I guess I'll say case development, happens within the hotline office itself before you shuffle it off for further investigation by another element of the department? I mean, how much validation do you do to say this seems legitimate before you either do something else with it or send it on to the appropriate investigative
right.
unit?
Our triage process has a team of trained investigators who read everything that comes in our inbox. And they look at it, and the first thing they're looking for is what the allegations are and what priority level to put it in. Because if it's a priority one emergency, they're going to raise their hand and get help from anyone around and as many people as we need to execute the mission to take care of that emergency right away.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to triage it. They're going to look at it, see what the elements are, see if it's credible, see if it's got enough information in it that we can take action. You know, something that says, I think that the such-and-such organization is committing fraud, and that's all it says. That's not a whole lot of action we could do with that. That would probably be non-referred.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they said that the such-and-such organization was committing fraud by doing so-and-so, that gets us down the road to where it would likely be a referral. But we would look for all the elements that we need to take action on something. And so then some referrals are for action, where we are sending it downstream to another organization and telling them that we're requiring you to look into this, and we set a suspense, and when you're done, you need to send us back a hotline completion report, and then we will conduct oversight of the matter that you investigated. Another type of referral is an informational referral. It might be something that doesn't require action, or we might not know if it requires action. But we send it to downstream to that respective organization anyway, because it might be something that they need to be aware of. And it also might be the missing piece to the puzzle that when we give it to them, now they see the big picture and they realize it requires action. So when we send an info referral, we tell them that they're not required to report back to us unless they realize they need to take action. They do take action, and they substantiate it. We want to know the results.
Mm. So it sounds like part of the message, if I'm getting this right, is that, you know, if you're coming to the hotline, you don't necessarily need to present evidence, a smoking gun of fraud, but you do need to point you guys with some credible information that you can pursue and start building a case. Is that about right?
You use the right buzzwords, credible information. Mm-hmm. Send us credible information, and we'll take it from there. We're the investigators. The investigators who we send it to are doing the investigating. We're not asking you to prove a case. We're just asking you to get us started in the right direction.
That's Patrick Gookin, the director of the Defense Department Inspector General's hotline. We'll come back after a short break and talk more about, among other things, the push toward eliminating the backlog of complaints within the hotline office. This is On DOD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, I'm Jared Serbu. This is On DOD. Thanks for listening this week. Getting back into our conversation about the DOD Inspector General's Hotline program. Our guest is Patrick Gookin, the Hotline Director. Before the break, we were discussing the level of credible information someone ideally needs to have before they make a complaint or register a concern with the hotline, either by phone or online.
So, obviously, you do want people to come forward when they've got that credible information. Can you talk a little bit about the outreach that you do within the DOD community and beyond, and maybe how that's changed a bit in recent months, years?
Yes. In May of 2013, we held a global outreach where we invited all the federal hotlines, all the DOD and DOD agency hotlines, state hotlines, and non-government organizations. And we had a few hundred people attend. We had a panel of people from across the broad spectrum of hotlines up on stage. And we talked about issues common amongst us. And we shared our best practices so we could emulate each other. That spawned a DOD hotline working group and now a federal hotline working group. And in those working groups, we share best practices each quarter when we meet. And we are all becoming much more efficient and effective.
Can you describe what you think are maybe some of the few most important best practices that you all have come together and agreed around?
I don't know what to tell you is the most important ones. They're all important. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that our example that we exported of our phone tree to get non-purview items off your plate is very big, because most hotlines have backlog. They're overwhelmed with the number of complaints that come in, and you have to sort through all of them. And if they're not in your purview, you're expending man hours or resources on those non-purview matters.
Right.
And as I showed you earlier, that roughly 60% of our phone calls and 60% of our email traffic is now no longer coming in because we found means to get people to the right place if it's not within our purview.
Yeah, and those people's concerns aren't being ignored. They're just being sent to the proper venue.
That's correct.
So that's one best practice. Any others come to mind right away?
Yes, our email. We used to accept email complaints. And an email complaint might come in. It says, I want to report a fraud. And that's all it says. Mm-hmm. And we hit reply and say, please give us the details. And they might say it's a fraud in DOD. And we hit reply and ask them for more details, and it just gets this long relationship going back and forth to try and finally figure out that there's something that we need to take action on, or there was nothing all along to begin with. So now what we did is about 2 months shy of October 1st of 2013, we put an automatic reply on our email account that telling them on October 1st the email will be shut off. You'll no longer be able to file an email complaint. And we're directing you to our online web form. And when you fill out that web form, it's a structured form that asks the who, what, when, where, how, and why that we need to know. And it puts it in a format that we can expediently go through and dissect and evaluate to see if it is something within our purview and get it to the people downstream who need it soonest. And so we've created a much faster, a much better system for the customer, the complainant, to get his complaint where it needs to be soonest.
So hopefully you're getting the information you need the first time rather than
having
to go back and forth with 10 emails.
That's correct. And to give you an example of the efficiency that we've developed, this time last year, we could refer about 200 cases in a month. Last week, we probably referred 250 or 300 in a week rather than a month. The typical month in FY13 was 200. So we have quadrupled or fivefolded our output.
Yeah, that's significant.
So that is, we're taking care of the person who asks us for help.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine there's at least some degree of tension in a decision like that, because I assume you want the reporting process to be as easy as possible, as little friction in that process as humanly possible, so as to encourage people to come forward. Is it a difficult decision to create that more structured environment? Was there any level of concern that, you know, people might be less apt to actually hit that send button if they have to jump through these extra hoops?
There was great concern with it, but and after vetting it through the entire staff of the hotline and leadership and anyone and all the other hotlines for best practices, we knew that we would be better serving the customer if we could get their information and get the things within our purview and not have to use our resources on things that are not within our purview.
Mm-hmm.
And the proof is in the stats that I gave you, that quadrupled or fivefold of our processing ability of a year ago. And it's mainly from refinement of processes, including the phone tree and the email. We also tell them that if you can call us, we have an 800 number. When you call us, there's a phone tree that helps you get to the places you need to get fastest. And so particularly, you know, if you think if the complainant thinks it could be better addressed by their military IG, press 1. When you press 1, it says for the Army IG, press 2, et cetera. So that gets it to the place that we would have referred it to anyway. And if it goes to the Army IG without ever going to us, and it's something within our purview, the Army IG is going to send it to us. But it turns out that the majority of these complaints that are coming in, that we're giving them the options to send it to where they believe it should be first, it's working. So had it not worked, of course, we would have reverted back to what it was. But yeah, it's working very well.
That last point you made is interesting. How do we think about when the military service IG is the appropriate venue and when the DOD IG is the right organization to complain to?
It depends on the matter being complained about. If it's a DOD systemic issue, of course the DOD IG needs to learn of that.
Sure.
If it's solely an Army matter and for some reason the Army isn't conflicted out, then it would probably be appropriate to get it to the Army IG. If the complainant has an issue with sending it to the Army IG for whatever reason, they're certainly free to send it to us for us to do oversight. Or we might have it investigated internally here in the DOD IG.
Right. You mentioned a moment ago that many agencies have backlogs in their hotline programs. What's the status of DOD's backlog, if there is one?
There will be no backlog in about 3 weeks. Our processes have been refined to the point that in 3 weeks we'll be operating real time.
What's driven that? Is it a result of fewer complaints coming in, or of you redirecting complaints to the more appropriate place? What's driven that?
Well, first, what drove there to be backlog was a 125% increase in contacts to the hotline over about a 3 or 4 year period. So that increase wasn't necessarily because there's more crime. It's because we've marketed ourselves and branded ourselves and made ourselves accessible to the world to give us their input or complaints, what they think we should look at. So our resources had to be plussed up to keep up with the demand that we created when we reached out to people. We do it through outreach, public outreach. We do it through posters. We do it through TV ads. We do it through the internet. Any way we can reach someone to let them know, here's where you can call to get help for this matter. And it's working. It's working very well.
So explain to me how that works. More contacts and less backlog.
Well, it was more contacts and which created backlog, and then we streamlined our processes. And as I talked about, the phone tree and the email, and also eliminated any sort of redundancy that wasn't necessary. We still have quality control review, so that's the redundancy. But we have it to the extent that it's necessary, and that's it. And we refer it out. We let someone else then investigate it, and then we oversight review their work. Mm-hmm. So there's two reviews, when it goes out to make sure it's correct and when it comes back in. And one of the biggest things that we're conscious of is you have a privilege to speak with us privately, and we're very sensitive to protecting people's identity who do not consent to the disclosure of their identity. So that's scrubbed really hard in any documents that go out of the hotline if you did not consent to disclosure. Now, on the flip side of that, there are certain things that we can't have investigated if we don't provide your identity. Say you were reprised against by your superior. We can't go and investigate a superior if we don't know who they were supposedly reprised. Mm-hmm. Your name must be given. If you don't give your name for a reprisal case, it can't be investigated. And there are certain matters that if you report to the hotline that you don't want to disclose your identity, and I as the director have the regulatory authority to disclose your identity anyway, if it's an urgent matter or a life and safety matter or something in national security, if it's in the best interest of the world or the government, then that is going to have to outweigh someone's concern for privacy. Mm-hmm. That's rare. It's almost unheard of that we would do that. But that is built into the regulation.
I totally understand the value of anonymity, but would it be right to say that in most cases it's easier for you all to do your job if the person is willing to go on the record
Absolutely.
With their identity?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And there are some that if they still don't want to go that far, they provide us, the DOD hotline, their identity. If necessary, and this creates more resource-intense work, we will redact their complaint of their not only their name, but things, you know, if they were the only mail clerk in the widget factory, and we leave that I'm the mail clerk in the widget factory, my name is, and we blank out the name, well, everyone's going to know who it was. So we also redact things that might lead to their identity, if we can discern what those things are. And we would send that downstream to be investigated. And if the investigator says, hey, I have a question I need to ask this person, then they tell we're the mediator, the middle person. We call the complainant, ask them the question, get the answer, and give it to the investigator.
Right. I mean, are there special tricks that you need to use to convince people that you will effectively protect their identities, that you will redact their information, that they're not going to be reprised against because their information leaked to somewhere else?
Yeah, I don't want to use the word tricks. No, there are certain things we do, as in we disclose it right on the form. We explain it right on the web form that we ask you to fill out, and it goes through all those matters. Very clear, plain speak.
I guess my real question is it difficult to convince people that this is a safe place?
No, I don't think so. It probably has to do with the nature of the person themselves.
Right.
The average person, they're disclosing their identity. Most of them just want to make sure the right thing gets done.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's really what it's about. People are reporting because they want the right thing to be done with whatever they think their complaint is. Mm-hmm. And that's their primary concern.
Patrick Gookin is the director of the Hotline Program at the Defense Department Inspector General's Office. He'll join us for one more segment after another quick break. This is on DOD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin.
Thanks for listening to On DOD on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. One more segment this week with our guest, Patrick Gookin, the director of the DOD Inspector General's Hotline. We'll wrap up our discussion with some details about some example cases in the news that originated via that hotline. We talked earlier about sort of categories of cases in your various priority levels. Are there examples that come to mind of cases that originated through the hotline and ended up in, you know, sort of blockbuster investigations that caught people's attention or led to real change in the department?
Sure. Investigations into the Arlington National Cemetery mismanagement. Those were DOD hotlines, and it was a major news story from the national news media. Sexual assaults in the military. We get complaints about the particular places that have been investigated for egregious matters in sexual assaults in the military. Maria Lauterbach was the pregnant Marine who was murdered by another Marine down in North Carolina. A lot of that came in through the DOD hotline. The Dover Air Force Base mortuary affairs. Those matters came through the DOD hotline. A very recent one that's been in the news is the Navy officer and the NCIS agent, and now it's actually plural, naval officers that have been arrested for these multi-million dollar bribery cases involving husbandry of ships in the Pacific. That was a DOD hotline matter. Unfortunately, we don't give complainants updates. We can't. We have to protect the integrity of the investigation and the privacy of everyone involved in the investigation. So the people who told us about this matter in the Philippines and Singapore and elsewhere about the ship husbandry, they may have thought that the government just wasn't doing anything. Mm-hmm. So they're probably really proud now when they read the news and see that.
Is there a way around that? Is there a way to reassure people that, yeah, we're working on it without disclosing details of what you've actually discovered in the course of the investigation?
We do that. When you file a complaint, we tell you we have your complaint. We are looking at your complaint. We can't give you an update, but we will notify you when it's closed. When it's closed, you can ask for a copy of the case through the Freedom of Information Act. And otherwise, we do not communicate anything about any case, no details, even when it's closed. You must go through the FOIA process to get it because they're the experts on what and how to release things. We're not.
I mean, one question that comes to mind about that is if the complainant doesn't know that you are actively working it and taking it very seriously, maybe they pursue other venues and there's duplication of resources because another IG somewhere else or a law enforcement agency somewhere else is conducting a parallel investigation and the two organizations aren't talking to each other. Does that question make sense?
Absolutely. And that's why we formed the Global Outreach last year and the DOD Hotline Working Group and the Federal Hotline Working Group. We're all talking. Everyone in the federal government hotlines are now talking. And we are looking at making communication systems, those things that we talked about in the 80s that computers could do where we could all be on the same page. We're actually doing that.
Hmm. Any other technological process changes that you've made that have helped get after the backlog problem or whatever that you want to talk about?
The most effective things were streamlining the processes so they are as lean as can be, but still effective. And the phone tree and the email, no more email and only the online form, those things got the non-purview matters off of our plate and sent those non-purview matters to the places that was appropriate for them. These streamlined processes has made it possible for us to use the same number of employees that we have now to deal with the influx of complaints.
And get a lot more workload actually processed.
Correct. As they say on the street, more bang for your buck.
So let me circle back to a topic we covered early on in the conversation, which is the types of things that you do want people to come forward with. I mean, what constitutes waste, fraud, and abuse? What are the things that are most going to get your attention that you want people to report?
All right, again, it's more than just waste, fraud, and abuse. Mm-hmm. It's threats to homeland defense. It's leaks of classified information, human trafficking, whistleblower reprisal, gross mismanagement, bribery, gratuities, conflicts of interest, health and safety issues, procurement irregularities. It goes on and on and on. But that's the main gist of what we're looking for.
You mentioned classified information. I imagine a lot of the work that you do requires you to perhaps take a look at classified information or process classified information. Are there avenues where people can bring things that are classified to your folks at the hotline or in the broader DOD IG?
Yes. On our website, the first thing you see at the top of the page is stop. If this is a classified matter, go here with it. When you go there, it opens it up so you can submit a classified complaint depending on the level of classification for secret or top secret. And we're available, and we export this and outreach this to the intelligence community or anyone else who we can possibly find that will listen, that we are the intake for complaints about classified matters within the DOD.
This might be kind of an off-the-wall question, but I assume if you're submitting classified material to the DODIG, you've got to do that over CIPRNet.
Absolutely.
Which is going to be your work computer, which is subject to monitoring by, you know, your boss, your supervisor, probably somebody. How do you submit that kind of information without, say you're a whistleblower, how do you submit that kind of information without being detected, if that is your wish?
I'm not certain how the complainant does it, but what we do is we offer you a link on the CIPRNet to send it to us. So I don't know who might be monitoring what on their workstation, but we're giving them the avenue to get it to us. They could also call us and tell us they'd like to talk about a classified matter, and we'd get on a secure line and do that. There are ways to get around if they want to get around their own boss seeing what they're reporting.
Patrick Gookin is the director of the DOD Inspector General's hotline. We talked at the IG's headquarters in Alexandria, Virginia. If you missed any of our discussion, we'll post the whole thing at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. We'll also post a link to the hotline's website, which, among other things, includes a detailed list of the types of issues that should be reported to the hotline and which ones should not. One more break this hour, and when we come back, we'll dig into some of the peculiarities of this year's DOD budget proposal. That's next on DOD, on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin.
Profile America, Wednesday, March 5th. A severe economic panic striking in 1893 led the city of Seattle to create the nation's first municipal unemployment assistance office on this date in 1894. State and federal unemployment assistance wasn't established until the 1930s. Recently, the national unemployment rate, as determined by the Census Bureau's current population survey, has settled to a little under 7%. In 2010, Washington State's average was at the then national average of 9.6%. The most current unemployment rate is one of the statistics immediately accessible on the Census Bureau's mobile application called America's Economy. You can find more statistics on communities across the country by downloading the Census Bureau's Dweller mobile application at census.gov/mobile.
Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is on DOD. I'm Jared Serbe. We'll finish out the show this week with a little bit of explanation of what the Pentagon is calling special features of the 2015 budget that officials there just released. The defense budget is a complex beast in any year, but it's even more so this year, in part because the actual budget document doesn't completely reflect what the department is asking Congress for. For example, DOD says it needs to maintain an 11-carrier Navy, but the budget proposal only includes funding for 10 carriers beyond 2016. DOD says it's also asking Congress to fund an army of up to 450,000 troops, but on paper, the budget only pays for 420,000. That's all despite the fact that the budget itself already proposes to spend more than what's allowed by current law under sequestration. We'll let Undersecretary of Defense Bob Hale take it from there. He's the DOD comptroller. This is a short excerpt from his budget explanation to reporters in the Pentagon briefing room.
So I want to address a particular aspect of this budget, and that is the service goals versus our FYDP. Let me describe this to you in connection with the Army active end strength at the top of this chart. The end of 14, we expect the Army to be about 510,000 in terms of active end strength. Our goal is to draw them down to about 440 to 450,000 by fiscal year 2009 in the absence of sequestration. And when we talk about risks, we are thinking of a 440-450 size army. If sequestration is prolonged and continues, we'll have to draw the army down further to 420,000, and you can see that there. The point I want to make is the asterisk on this chart, that 420,000 is in the five-year plan that we are submitting to Congress. Now, you might say, well, wait a minute, you budgeted above the sequester cap levels. Remember the dashed green line? So why is the army at sequester levels? And the answer is we don't know what Congress is going to do. Sequestration is the law, and so we can't be sure where we're going to end up. It takes time to plan for these major force changes like the one on this slide. And so we have put this plan in our five-year plan for these major items at the sequester level. If the Congress gives us an indication they will budget at the PB-15 level, the dashed green line in my chart, then we will end the Army drawdown in about fiscal 17 and leave them at 440 to 450. And let me address it with regard to carriers. Right now there are 10. Then when the Ford comes in 2016, we'll go back up to 11. Without sequester, we would like to stay at that level. With sequester, we'll have to go back to 10 by decommissioning the George Washington. Our five-year plan has the 10 in there because we have to plan for a major force cut. But if Congress indicates that they will budget at the PB-15 levels, we will not decommission the George Washington and leave the carrier fleet at 11. So this would normally be the wrap-up. Miller time, questions, what you all want, but there are special features to this budget in some fairly unusual times, and I want to address two of them. Next slide. The first one is the Opportunity, Growth, and Security Initiative. Focus on the red portion of this chart. I showed you the chart before. Focus on the red part, and in fiscal 15, there is a government-wide initiative called OGSI to add discretionary funding, fully offset by cuts in mandatory spending and increases in taxes associated with closing tax loopholes. For DOD, that would amount to a $26 billion increase in our budget. Again, the 496 is a standalone budget. That is what we have described to you in the words to date. That is what will be in our detailed budget documents. But the president's budget will ask for those $26 billion of additional funding. And let me tell you what's in that $26 billion. Next slide. About 40% of it would go for direct readiness enhancements, higher Army operating tempo so they can train more, more training and range support in the Air Force and the other things that you can see on the slide. About 40% of it would go for modernization improvements. We would spend more on helicopters in the Army, both Black Hawk and Apache. We would buy 8 more P-8 aircraft in the Navy, 2 more F-35s, and a number of the items that are there. And the final 10% goes for installation support increases, sustainment, and also military construction, both of which have been cut quite a bit in recent years. It's our judgment that we have shortfalls in training and maintenance in fiscal year 15 that lead to some readiness risks, near-term risk, as Secretary Hagel has characterized them. If we were to get this added appropriation, it would significantly mitigate those risks. And next slide, the last special feature is what happens if we go to sequestration level budgets. And again, focus on the red part of the slide. I've been talking to you about the dashed green line, the PB-15 request. But in order to realize that request in the years beyond 15, Congress is going to have to change the caps, law, and raise the discretionary caps. What if they don't do that? What happens to our forces? We would see reduced capability in a variety of ways. Our end strength cuts would be below our pre-sequester goals. That's an Army to 420. It's a Marine Corps instead of saying at 182 to 175. Smaller Guard and Reserve in the Army. We'd have 10 aircraft carriers and 9 wings instead of the 11 carriers and 10 wings that we would prefer to keep. Same proposals in military compensation in terms of slowing the growth, although they're probably more important. We'd have to go to further force cuts beyond what I've already described, retiring the entire KC-10 fleet, retiring the fleet of Global Hawk Block 40s, fewer Predators and Reapers. We would have less recovery and readiness, although a lot of things influence readiness. The operation and maintenance budget is important, grows at 3% a year under the president's budget, less than 2% at sequester level budget. It will hamper the recovery in readiness. Less growth in procurement in a variety of ways, and I've just given you two examples. Overall, what Secretary Hagel has said is, as Christine Worma said before me, prolonged sequestration would significantly increase the risks, significantly increase the chances we could not carry out the strategy. And as the Secretary said in his speech, if we accept prolonged sequestration, we are gambling that our military will not have to engage in simultaneous military contingencies. Next slide. So let me summarize both the dollars and the words that Secretary Hagel has used to describe the risks in this budget. The budget at 496 is at the cap levels in fiscal 15, grows beyond that in beyond the years fiscal 16 and beyond. Near-term gaps in training and maintenance pose risk to readiness. The Opportunity Growth and Security Initiative would mitigate those. Longer-term risks as well, especially with regard to simultaneous, multiple simultaneous contingencies, and much higher risks if we end up going to prolonged sequestration. And my last slide, as I always promise in these, is if you can't sleep, then you can go to our website. There's lots of mind-numbing detail on there about our budget.
That's Undersecretary of Defense Bob Hale, the DOD comptroller, explaining some of the stranger nuances of this year's DOD budget proposal. You can find a lot more of our coverage of the rollout of the 2015 federal budget at federalnewsradio.com, and plenty more to come, I'm sure, as the process grinds along in the coming months on Capitol Hill. Earlier this hour, we talked with Patrick Gookin, the director of the Defense Department Inspector General's Hotline Program. If you missed that conversation, we'll post this full show, as always, at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. That's it for this week's program. Thanks again for listening to Federal News Radio. I'm Jared Serbin. So long.
You've been listening to On DOD with Federal News Radio DOD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DOD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.